The leading question, what is the present trade debate really about? From Washington, D.C., CBS Radio presents The Leading Question, a spontaneous and unrehearsed transcribed discussion. Now here is the moderator of the program, Paul Niven.
The basic law governing the conditions of this country's foreign trade is the Reciprocal Trades Agreement Act. There have been a series of them since 1934. The present act expires next June 3rd and must be renewed or replaced by the Congress before that date. The debate will be heated. On the one hand, some business and labor groups are demanding more protection against foreign competition. They say that low tariffs have helped cause the present high rate of unemployment in this country. On the other hand, the administration's Undersecretary of State for Economic Affairs, George Ball, has called for broad tariff reductions and a sharp departure from protectionism. Will Clayton, one of Mr. Ball's predecessors, and Christian Herter, the last Secretary of State, have endorsed that view and called for a trade partnership with the European Common Market. Our guests today are Charles P. Taft, General Counsel for the Committee for National Trade Policy, and Oscar Strachbein, Chairman of the Nationwide Committee on Import-Export Policy. Our leading question is, what is the present trade debate really about? Mr. Taft.
You've given the main outlines of this. The act expires after a four-year life, which is the longest of any of these provisions. But the reason the 4 years has not been adequate to complete the job is because negotiations with the common market, using the authority of the 1958 Act, could not begin until just within recent months. In fact, the major part of this negotiation goes now, and it is much complicated by the addition of Great Britain as a probable member, along with now the Scandinavian countries and Ireland, perhaps even Switzerland, so that it becomes all the more necessary to make sure that our goods can still get into Europe. The controversy, on the other hand, can be stated pretty well by Mr. Strachbein. Perhaps he might do it. That's our position on it.
I would say that essentially the problem is one of competition. And the character of competition. The United States is a country that outproduces other countries of the world. We need world markets. We have world markets. Other countries want to ship in here, and they do ship in here. But the question arises, and has been before us for some time, what is the effect on the United States economy of these imports? That's why I say it is essentially a question of the character of competition provided by imports. We in this country have a high level of productivity going hand in hand with high wages. In the past, these high wages were offset considerably by the fact that other countries were not as productive as we in this country. Therefore, our high wages nonetheless permitted low unit costs of production. Now, however, the other countries, and many of them, the leading industrial countries of the world, have our machinery and modern equipment and our technology. Yet, at the same time, their wages are from a third to a quarter of ours, and in some case, much less. As a result of this, they come out with lower unit of cost of production than we do, and of course this makes for very difficult import competition for many of our industries and some of our agricultural groups.
Mr. Taft.
Well, I think the best answer I can give to that last point, at least, is from the recent study by the National Industrial Conference Board, which is, I assure you, in past practice, not prejudiced particularly on our moderate tariff side, which indicates that the costs in the common market, and they're talking now about the net costs, including wages, more important with us than with them. In the common market, we're 97% of those in the United States, only 3% under. In Great Britain, perhaps 84%, that is 16% under. Whereas in Latin America, in Australia, in Canada even, in Japan, they're definitely higher. 9% higher in Japan, 25% higher in Latin America, one of the underdeveloped countries. Usually the charge is made that it's the very low wages in places like Hong Kong that are giving us the trouble.
I ask that what you're referring to? 16% or 9%?
16% in Australia.
What? 16% of what, may I ask?
of what is considered by the National Industrial Conference Board the comparative costs of producing one unit of a product in different parts of the world. And this is taken from American manufacturers who manufacture both here and abroad. This is almost the only basis of comparison, because as soon as you try to find out what manufacturers who are not American are paying for a unit cost in other countries, the statistics are unavailable, they're kept secret, they simply cannot be compared. I would agree to that. But all the evidence that has been found certainly rejects Mr. Strachbein's position that the costs abroad are way under ours. This is not so, although the wages may be.
Well, Mr. Taft, may I simply point out that the proof of the pudding is in the eating of it. I don't care what these studies show, and you must admit, and I think you have admitted, that it is extremely difficult to make comparisons of cost to unit cost. But when the goods come into the United States, landed at prices at which we cannot sell, there is the test of the pudding. Not what somebody says who doesn't have time to go into cost statistics and cost accounting. They may have certain experiences where in this particular product, the cost may be 5 or 10% lower abroad than here, or in a few cases where it may be higher. But the proof of the pudding is in the fact that when the goods are landed here, in many cases they come in here and are offered at prices lower than the American producer himself can produce it, allowing nothing even for profit.
I would only answer on that that some of the cases that Mr. Strachbein would cite are due to dumping of remnants that have been left when people tried to manufacture abroad and had to stop. This is true, has been true in Japan. But the test of the pudding is in the eating. That I agree to. On manufactured goods, we are exporting $4 billion a year, and we are importing only $1 billion. This has continued over the last several years. The percentage of imports of manufactured goods has been higher, actually, in the past than it was in 1960. And the proof is right there that we are able to export abroad against this kind of competition to the extent of $4 billion, and only $1 billion has been able to come in here and compete.
Mr. Taft, I simply have got to challenge that statement that on a basis of fact. The imports of the United States, the proportion of our total imports that now consist of finished manufacturers, has almost doubled in the last 10 years. 35% of our imports are now manufactured finished products, and 10% additional consist of manufactured foodstuffs, so that of our total imports, 45% are manufactured finished goods. And the trend has been definitely upward, whereas the trend of our exports has been definitely downward. The proportion of in the mix of our exports, the proportion of manufactured goods is going down.
Well, I can only say that the
we
figures
must be
I've,
using different statistics.
Figures that I've
you,
got
I have
for
just been over this. Please.
Figures that I've got for merchandise imports. Now, this excludes the military. Merchandise
yes.
imports is somewhat under $3 billion. If you say 35 billion. 35% is the percentage of manufactured goods. That gets you down to $1 billion, which is just what I said.
Well, gentlemen, apparently you can't agree on these figures. May I ask another
question?
I'll be
glad to use the statistical abstract of the United States as my referee.
Well, I would prefer to use the Department of Commerce and the Tariff Commission.
That comes from the Department of Commerce by way of the Census Bureau. Mr.
That takes a long time to get there.
Gentlemen, do your organizations have any estimates of how many jobs are threatened by or have been lost to foreign competition, and similar figures on how many American jobs are dependent upon exports? Mr. Taft.
Go ahead, Mr. Taft.
The most recent study is several years back, but I have no reason to think that it's any different so far as those who are dependent upon exports and upon imports. 40% of what is paid for an import goes to American wage earners of some kind, because that's what you pay after it gets to the port. The total number that has been estimated in the past is based on exports, employment, I would say is around 4 million. This is, as I say, a rather older statistic than I would like to use, but it nevertheless is the only one that there is. The numbers that are involved in losing, of that, I might say, a million and a million anyway, a million and a half perhaps, are people who are employed on imports. This is not just exports, but on foreign trade, employed in the United States on imports. So that all of this contributes to employment. So far as those jobs lost by import competition are concerned, I can give one, which in 55 was told us as an industry that was going to be knocked out of business completely. This was Velveteens, in which there were about 1,200 people employed at that stage. In 1958, 3 years later, when we had been told that the industry would go out of business, there were still 900 employed on Velveteens. So that the number that had been lost is certainly very limited, and the various estimates that have been made by those who have studied it don't put it over 200,000 or 300,000 at most.
I think that that is an underestimate. I think it is grossly underestimated. But let me point out that the problem is not merely that of how many people lose their jobs because of import competition. It is also a question of who is not being employed because of imports. We have over 1 million of new workers coming on the labor market every year, not to mention a degree of unemployment that is constantly rising. After each recession, after we come out of each recession now in the last 10 years, we have been left at the peak of prosperity with a higher number of unemployed than before. So today we have, 5.5 million unemployed. But
excuse
on
me,
top
four,
of that...
4 million the last time.
I say this now, I say.
Now I'm today. Talking about the last figures, day before yesterday, 4 million.
All right. Then we have made some headway. Kids have gone back to college. But we are facing a higher degree of chronic unemployment than we have before. And I would like to ask Mr. Taft, if he were represented an industry, or if he were a trade association in an industry, or the head of a large company, and if he were faced by the type of import competition that confronts many of these industries, whether he would be inclined, in the face of difficult import competition, to expand his plant, to open up new branches, or would he do as many other companies are doing, not necessarily as a substitute for expansion in this country, but rather than expanding as much here as he otherwise would have, takes part of his money and goes to Europe or Japan and invests there rather than investing that additional amount here. Now, that is the problem that we pose, that we are up against a situation where the import competition acts as a dampener on the very kind of growth and expansion that we have got to have in this country to absorb the people are coming on the labor market and the unemployed both.
All right, I'll be very glad to answer it, and I'll start with automobiles. The manufacturers of automobiles in the United States insisted that we had to have longer and longer automobiles and we had to have fins. Now, I'm not objecting to fins, although I understand they're going out from the latest reports, but I certainly am objecting to it if I can't buy any automobile without fins. And the only way that this was brought about was by imports. The result was that the American manufacturers, instead of just giving up and lying down and rolling over, which is what apparently Mr. Strachbein is advocating here, instead of that, they started in with compacts, and they have now pushed compacts up to 30 to 40% of the market. Now, this is exactly what we think American manufacturers ought to do, and they're doing it with goods that they produce in the United States and for the United States. Now, to put it on the other end of the thing, there is also the question involved as, for instance, in business machines, where they started selling typewriters and adding machines, simple ones. They went into complicated bookkeeping machines, and as the foreigners began to make the more simple item, they went way up in electronics, and the result was that they have gone up 50 to 60% in their total exports and their total production in the course of, say, the last 5 or 6 or 7 years. Now, this is the way American manufacturers ought to do it, and the stimulus of competition is the only way they are pushed into doing it.
Now, actually, the automobile industry itself has fallen way behind in absorbing or adding to employment if we measure what they should do by the increase in population. Now, I'll admit that that is not necessarily the standard. There will be industries that do not keep up with the growth in population in the number of employees they add. And this is because of more and more automation and greater productivity, so that they can put out a greater volume of goods with fewer workers. But I do want to point out that the more that our industries are confronted with difficult import competition, and also with great difficulty of holding foreign markets and not losing them to lower-cost producers abroad, there will be that much more pressure for automation in this country, and that in turn will cause more unemployment rather than absorbing more workers.
Well, I never have agreed with the technocrats, and I don't now. Automation in the end produces more employment, and it will have produced more employment here. But what Mr. Strachbein says about losing to foreign manufacturers leads me to make my most important point on the general subject which you have put before us this time, and that is that we are now faced with a special problem and an extremely serious one. The common market was bad enough. This has almost 200 million, I suppose more, population in which their internal tariffs were steadily going down, approaching zero, and in which their external tariffs were going up in many cases because they went to the average instead of staying at the low point.
May I interrupt, Mr. Tuff?
Yes, sir.
When you say the common market was bad enough, do you mean you believe the common market is a bad thing?
That was a bad phrase. No, I'm for it, but it was bad enough from the standpoint that Mr. Strachbein is talking about in this last moment about losing to foreign competition, because we are being kept out and are going to be increasingly kept out by the contrast between a free trade zone on the inside of a population which is just as big as ours, as compared to an outward tariff which keeps us out, makes a differential far greater than anything has been for Europe. Now, Europe is basic so far as we're concerned, because we are exporting our business, so far as Europe is concerned, is nearly $6 billion. And our surplus of exports over imports, which is probably $5 billion, at least three of it is in going to Europe. So that this becomes more and more important on our balance of payments and on everything else. Now, when Great Britain and then the Scandinavian countries and Ireland all are coming closer and closer to going into the common market and getting behind this same wall, then it becomes absolutely essential that we should approach them on a negotiating basis in order to get ourselves into that market and keep us there.
Mr. Strachbein, do you feel the common market presents a challenge? How would you respond?
I do indeed. This changes the subject slightly. I have not quite finished
with the
other part.
Well, this is the subject we started with, if I
may say. We spoke of the automotive industry and the tendency of more and more industries to invest overseas. Perhaps the most dramatic example of this was the investment of $365 million... by the Ford Motor Company in England. Now, they already had control, so it was not a question of their seeking control so that they could determine their own policies. But if you consider or ask the question, why did the Ford Motor Company, instead of investing that money in the United States where it would have given employment to tens of thousands of workers, why did they invest in England rather than in the United States? And if you answer that question, I think you will have the eating of the pudding that I was talking about. Evidently, in the mind of the Ford Motor Company, the possible and likely return on that money invested in England would be better than in the United States, and for several reasons. One, they would be inside of this common market, or next to it. If England goes in, they will be inside of it. And they will then, instead of trying to export from here over there, they will serve that market from within, and they will use that market as a base, perhaps, of exporting outward into Latin America and Asia rather than from the United States. Now, the point that I make is that we have got to have a better investment climate in this country so that more of these investments will take place here rather than seeking low-wage havens in other countries.
Well, the $300 million Ford investment in England was obviously a hedge against the common market and against exactly the danger that I've described. And the only way that that's going to be met is by an imaginative program of the kind that George Ball presented for the administration and that Mr. Herter and Mr. Clayton presented on their own behalf, but as leading citizens who have been involved in this, of course, in official capacities. This involves two things, primarily. The main one is that any negotiations that we do should not be on an individual item basis, but should be on a percentage across the board. This is the way in which the countries in Europe have actually gone to work on this. And the proof of the pudding there is also in the eating, because Germany and France were two of the highest protectionist countries in the world. When they got through with this, they were for it. Even the protectionists are for the common market within France and Germany. That's exactly what we predict if the United States adopts this forward-looking policy given by Mr. Ball as apparently the spokesman for the administration.
The differences between the European countries economically, production-wise and so forth, was not as great, not nearly as great, as the difference between the United States and those countries. Just as the difference between our southern states and our northern states was not as great as it is between the United States and other countries. So those countries can much more easily take down the internal tariff compartments without upsetting their production. But when the difference is as great as it is between the United States on the one hand and those countries on the other, then, mind you, I'm not saying that this should not at some time be done, but let us not believe that we would gain anything from going into the common market. England isn't even in there yet.
Well, this is, I assure you that this is the only kind of step that will produce a push forward. The increase in productivity in those foreign countries has been far greater during these years of the common market than it ever was before, and we have gone slowly behind them. This is the time for us to take a forward step on this kind of a field. If there is difficulty, then a trade adjustment program could meet it. They have one in the common market. They haven't had to use it.
Gentlemen, in 30 seconds each, will the administration put forward Mr. Ball's program at the next session, or will it wait until after the 62 elections? And when the Congress does receive the program, will it pass it?
I'll let Mr. Taft answer that. He's much closer to them than I am. I can assure I'm not in their confidence.
Well, there are two pieces to that question. I'm sure Mr. Strachbein will want to answer the second one. He won't answer the same way for me either. We're not in the confidence of the administration. We don't know whether they're going to come forward with this or not. Mr. Ball is a responsible official. He is the principal official in this field. And when he says this is what he's for, I assume it is going to be the administration policy.
Will Congress pass it?
As to whether Congress will pass it, I can't tell you. My guess, just roughly, is that there are probably 60 Republican votes available. Whether the Democrats can put together 140, I don't know. That would pass it.
I will say that the House or the Congress
That's
would not
the House
pass
I was talking about.
Well, the Congress would not pass such a bill if it were presented in the manner that it is now indicated. If there is a tremendous compromise proposal put forward, it might have some possibilities. But certainly not any proposal that we join the common market, or even that we line up alongside of it. Let me say that we have been bargaining now for 27 years, and presumably we have bargained for tariff reductions in those countries. What have our diplomats been doing all these years? They were supposed to have had low tariffs in Europe, generally, compared with the United States.
Well,
have reduced our tariffs by 80%. What have they done? Now, all at once, we have to scale their tariff walls again. Where did they come from?
Well, they've produced $6 billion of exports to Europe.
Gentlemen, thank you for joining in this discussion of our leading question.